And first of all, as far as reading goes, von Mises was probably the first modern economist to write a full-blown book on bureaucracy, the economics of bureaucracy, that is. And it's his 1944 book, Bureaucracy, that Rothbard cites. Rothbard also mentions a 1965 book by Gordon Tullock, who was a professor of mine in graduate school, and it's called The Politics of Bureaucracy. And then in the public choice literature, another book that's considered to be somewhat of a classic is by William Niskanen. That's spelled N-I-S-K-E-N. And it's, I think it's Bureaucracy and Representative Government was the title of it. And it was also an early book, late 60s, I think, early 70s maybe, on bureaucracy. And there's a big literature of bureaucracy, mostly in the sub-discipline of public choice. But the Austrians have also been writing about it for a long time. And Mises' book, Bureaucracy, precedes anything. Public choice as a sub-discipline didn't even exist until the 1960s, 20 years after Mises wrote that book. So those are some of the classics. And, of course, there's a big literature on it now in the economics journals. But I thought... Rothbard's commentary on bureaucracy and his history of the American experience would be useful to understand because the American experience is not very unique. Other countries have copied and adopted many of the same institutions. And so all of that long discussion of the history of the development of the civil service system, so-called, in America, is very similar to what has happened in other countries as well. So it's not just unique to America. And I guess the first point I would try to elaborate on is Rothbard's discussion of comparing market versus political elites. He talks about how there's a natural aristocracy, if you will, in many areas of life, including the market and in politics. But of course, there are very big differences between an elite, if you will, or aristocracy, whatever you want to call it, in the market versus politics. In the market, IBM and the executives of IBM were at the top for a long, long time until you get to the 1970s. And what happened in the 1970s? Well, Microsoft eclipsed IBM in the computer business. And so even though the mighty IBM, one of the biggest corporations in the world, was thought of as being a nest of corporate elites who would be there forever. A bunch of young kids, including a Harvard dropout, Bill Gates, eclipsed Microsoft in the computer business. And then the same happens over and over again. In the 1950s, General Motors was part of the big three automakers that dominated the world in automobile sales. General Motors was so successful that they had an ongoing management policy beginning in the 1940s where the managers of all the plants and subdivisions of GM were instructed to do whatever they can to make sure that General Motors never got more than a 40% market share among the big three because they thought that would attract an antitrust lawsuit by the government. And then, of course, we get to today where General Motors is bailed out by the federal government and de facto nationalized because it's in such a sorry state financially. And, of course, the Japanese automakers eclipsed the elites, the corporate elites of the big three automakers in America during the 1970s and 1980s. And so the market rules in terms of looking at elitists or an aristocracy. It might be there for a long time, for many years, but the only way they can really be there for many years is to be better than everyone else in serving the consumer. Political elites, on the other hand, can and do stay forever, seemingly, because they don't have to serve consumers. They pretty much dictate to us what they're going to give us, and then they have the ability to force us with threats of imprisonment to pay for these things, whether we want these things or not. And so, and also the system is very much rigged. If you were to Google congressional incumbent reelection rates, you'll find some charts showing the re-election rates in the U.S. House of Representatives and in the Senate over the past 50 years or so. And it's generally been around in the 90% to 95% range because the system is pretty much rigged, whereby through gerrymandering or the redrawing of congressional districts, for example, they guarantee that every member of Congress who's a Republican or a Democrat runs in a district that is has a big majority of Republicans or Democrats. They also have professional staff paid for by the taxpayers who are mostly taxpayer-financed campaign workers. And, of course, challengers have a tough time raising the money to challenge that. And, of course, if you're a member of Congress, you get yourself on numerous committees that dish out all sorts of subsidies to all the voting groups in your district. And challengers can't promise all that something for nothing money, or so it seems, to challenge the incumbents. And so the incumbents have the system pretty well rigged and filled with barriers to entry, to use an economic phrase, so that they do stay there forever. Even Barney Frank, who about 20 years ago was in the front pages of the Washington Post for a couple of weeks, because his boyfriend had been running a house of prostitution out of the basement of his townhouse on Capitol Hill, and Barney claimed to know nothing at all about it, and yet he's been reelected, 10 times since? And so it's almost impossible to unseat an incumbent, even in the most recent congressional elections, where the so-called Tea Party was so influential, there was still about at least an 80% reelection rate among incumbents. And so you don't see the type of turnover in politics that you do in markets. And as far as presidents go, the political parties pretty much control who the nominees will be, who the acceptable nominees will be. And so there's really not much turnover there either, in that they're all pretty much the same. Obama continues Bush's foreign policy. He hires Bush's defense secretary, for example. And so even though there's a different face in the White House, the policies haven't changed all that much from big spending, big government Bush, and foreign policy interventionism Bush, to big government, big spending, foreign policy interventionism Obama, or whoever comes next, with the possible exception of Ron Paul, I suppose. And so that's the first point that Rothbard makes here, and that it's very difficult. In this whole discussion, I think what Rothbard was thinking of is there's a literature in economics in the field of industrial organization on this, and it's called the Structure Conduct Performance Paradigm. A classic book on this is Concentration, Mergers, and Public Policy by Yale Brosen. And Yale Brosen also wrote an article on this subject in the Freeman many years ago. Actually, I think it was entitled Are U.S. Manufacturing Industries Monopolized. It was in the Freeman. It was a brief summary of some of the important points that Yale Brosen made in his book. And one of the things that he showed was he gathered a lot of statistics on American manufacturing industry, dozens of industries, according to market share and profitability. And he looked at the rankings of industries in terms of profitability over time during the peaks of different business cycles. He tried to control for the effects of the business cycle by only looking at the peaks. And generally what he found was that firms or industries that were exceptional in terms of profitability in any one year tended to descend toward the median in terms of profitability over the succeeding 10 or 12 years, and firms near the bottom in terms of profitability ascended toward the median as well over the next 10 or 12 years. And so there's a lot of fluidity in U.S. manufacturing markets in Brosen's book, Concentration, Mergers, and Public Policy. And this is the type of thing Rothbard is talking about markets. Well, yes, at any one point in time, if you take a snapshot view of markets or a static view of markets, it seems like there are these very wealthy people who have made a killing, but they are inevitably overtaken by somebody else, by competition, as long as the government allows competition, which, of course, it does not always do that. The cable industry executives were fat and happy for a long, long time, until they got competition from satellites, for example, and until some cities in America started breaking up the cable monopolies by allowing competition. And so even legal monopolies, government-imposed monopolies, are overthrown by technology. Email has destroyed the postal monopoly, for example, for the most part. And it's really the consumer who's in charge. And Rothbard quotes a part of one of my favorite passages from Human Action by Ludwig von Mises. And in the passage, I think it's page 276 of Human Action. If anybody has a copy of Human Action or has access to it, and after I read you this, it's 270 actually, page 270 of the Scholar's Edition of Human Action, which is online at Mises.org. And I want to read the whole thing because it's one of my favorite passages about how the consumer is really in charge in a free market economy. And this is Ludwig von Mises. He says, neither the entrepreneurs nor the farmers nor the capitalists determine what has to be produced. The consumers do that. If a businessman does not strictly obey the orders of the public as they are conveyed to him by the structure of market prices, he suffers losses, he goes bankrupt. Other men who did better in satisfying the demand of the consumers replace him. The consumers make poor people rich and rich people poor. They determine precisely what should be produced in what quality and what quantities. They are merciless, egoistic bosses, full of whims and fancies, changeable and unpredictable. They do not care a whit for past merit and vested interest. In their capacities as buyers and consumers, they are hard-hearted and callous, without consideration for other people. Now, that's you who he's talking about as a consumer. And even though on the outside you might see the bankers or the corporate executives seem to be in charge of what gets produced and in what quantities and what qualities, but it's ultimately the consumer who has to fork over his or her money that controls all of this. And they can turn on you on a whim like they did with IBM, like they did with the big three automakers, when superior Japanese cars showed up on the market, and so forth. And that's an important point to keep in mind as the big difference between government and markets, because, of course, governments, there is no profit and loss system in government, and therefore there's no need to pay any attention to consumers. There are no consumers. There are only taxpayers in government. Another useful thing to talk about here is there's sort of a taxonomy that Rothbard refers to of the three type of enterprises that exist in most countries, at least non-communistic countries, that organize production. You've got private enterprise, you've got the non-profit sector, the private non-profit sector. In the U.S., there are many tens of thousands of charities. The Mises Institute is a nonprofit organization, for example. And then you have government enterprises. And this is a useful way of thinking about it because the basic question to be addressed is, well, what motivates the managers of these enterprises to cater to the customers, to cater to the consumers or the people who are supposed to be the beneficiaries of their actions? Well, of course, in the free market, under private enterprise, in the profit and loss system, you have all kinds of incentives. You're rewarded with profits by enhancing the lives of your customers, and you're penalized with losses if you don't. And professional managers also are rewarded in their careers because of this. You don't have to be a sole proprietorship because Rothbard does allude to what we call the separation of ownership from control, where quite some years ago there was a famous book called The Corporation and Private Property. The two authors were Burley and Means, Gardner Means and Adolph Burley. They were advisors to Franklin Roosevelt. The book was published in the 1930s, and they made the case for more government regulation of business because they said America is no longer a country of sole proprietorships. There are corporations run by professional managers, and so the controllers are the professional managers, whereas the owners are the shareholders, and they argued that the controllers, the professional managers, can pretty much do what they want and run the corporations for their own benefit primarily, and the hell with the customers or the shareholders. And of course, they can never ignore customers. That's foolish to believe that. And but there is a separation of ownership from control, as they said. But the marketplace again has mechanisms. One mechanism is the takeover market, the market for corporate control, as it's called, and that any corporation that is not doing its best to maximize profits creates a profit incentive for a takeover specialist who use such things as proxy battles, proxy fights, to buy up enough stock in that company. This is usually groups of very wealthy investors to get a majority of the board of directors. Then they use that power to kick out the existing management and replace them with other people in a different business plan. And it doesn't always work, but the idea is they are now incentivized to make sure it works because they own all this stock and they have every incentive to do their best to increase the profitability of the company by cutting costs, improving product quality or both, and make more money for the shareholders. No company is omniscient or free of corruption, for that matter, and so this doesn't always work, but at least the incentives are in the right way. And also, professional managers are given bonuses and stock options that reward them personally for increasing profits, long-run profits, and the opposite. If they don't increase profits, it's bad for your career. If you hope to proceed in your career with promotions, it's all about profitability. And how do you make profits in a free market? You please the customers, as Nissen said. And so the market has these mechanisms that have developed spontaneously that at least minimize the abilities of managers to use the corporation or the corporation's money for their own personal benefit and not for the benefit of the owners, the stockholders, or the customers, although there is always some slack in the system. That doesn't exist in government at all, and there's also finally the survivor principle in the private sector, where if you don't do a good job in serving the customers, you simply won't survive. Now the nonprofit sector, the second type of enterprise, nonprofit enterprises, they don't have customers, so they have donors, and so although some do, you may argue that say. The AARP, the organization that purports to represent retired people, they do sell magazines and things like that, but primarily they get most of their money through donations, and so they don't really have a big customer base, and they're not based on customers. Donors are their main focus, nor do they have stockholder or investor pressure like corporations do, because they don't have stockholders. They're nonprofit organizations, and it's illegal to distribute whatever profit there is, so-called, to shareholders. That's what makes them a nonprofit organization. It doesn't mean they don't have profits or they don't pursue profits. It just means they can't share them with stockholders. And so they don't have those pressures either. And so the one pressure they do have to please their donors is they want more donations, and they want a good record. And so there's a lot more slack in the nonprofit sector than there is the private enterprise sector on the part of managers, professional managers, to get away with sort of running the organization for their own benefit or the way they see it, even if their wishes are opposed to what the donors want. Most of you, or many, maybe all of you, are familiar with stories about universities, for example, that are nonprofit organizations that receive large financial donations from alumni to do one thing. And then they take the alumni's money, and then they do something else with it. And so they seem to have a lot more latitude to do that sort of thing than do private enterprises. And then the third type of enterprise that Rothbard mentions, government enterprise, is even worse, has even more latitude than nonprofit private enterprises do to ignore the ostensible consumers, because there are no consumers in a sense of a market. Place. There is no market feedback mechanism. There are only taxpayers or victims, if you will, who pay taxes and are forced to pay taxes to provide whatever the government wants to give us. And so you don't have stockholder pressure, you don't have customer pressure, and you don't have donor pressure because you're not seeking donations. You have the ability to compel people to give you money to finance your operations. And so for those reasons alone, without even getting into all the various incentives that exist in bureaucracy, of the three types of institutions that we use to provide goods and services, government is by far the worst in terms of the basic incentives to serve the people it claims to serve. So that's one thing. Rothbard briefly mentions it. I thought I'd mention a little more of it. Now, in the private sector, of course, with competition, the incentives are to minimize cost, because minimized cost translates into maximizing profit. Profit is simply the gap between the revenue a business takes in and the cost of providing the good or service. So if you can reduce the cost, you increase profits, and everybody associated with the enterprise tends to benefit. That's why, for example, capitalism has built-in incentives for the conservation of natural resources, because if you use fewer natural resources to produce some product, and that doesn't mean you necessarily have become an environmentalist or have joined the Sierra Club. It means out for how to make more money. Fewer resource use means lower cost and higher profits. When Coca-Cola, for example, drastically reduced the amount of aluminum it puts into Coca-Cola cans, so that a 10-year-old child could probably rip a Coca-Cola can apart with his or her bare hands. It didn't do it because it became an environmentalist and thought it was a group of environmentalists and thought that it's a shame that we're mining so much bauxite to produce aluminum. They saw a lot of money in using less aluminum in their cans. Not only the savings of the amount of aluminum that they use, but it's lighter, and the shipping costs are bound to be much lower when you're shipping millions and millions of cans of Coca-Cola around the world. And so there are built-in incentives for energy conservation and natural resource conservation, which is all about profit and cost minimizing. In the government, the opposite is the case. The exact opposite. The incentives are all in favor of cost maximization. And one reason for this is laid out as one of the themes of the William Niskanen book that I mentioned earlier on bureaucracy and representative government, in that he says that, well, in the private sector, where we have profit and losses, corporate executives can benefit by making more profits, because their salaries and their perks, their perquisites, are often tied to profitability. And so they can directly benefit throughout their careers by making more profits for the stockholders. In the government, though, it's illegal to take home any excess revenue over costs. And so government bureaucrats tend to be budget maximizers. That's how they benefit from being managers. Because with a bigger budget, what do? Well, you have more perquisites. You have more travel to exotic locations for conferences. You have more staff to be underlings working under you. You might have more exotic furnishings and headquarter buildings and so forth. And also, it's true, it's been known to be true for a very long time for people who have studied bureaucracy, and that the principal ingredient of getting promoted in a government bureaucracy is how many people work under you. That's the first question every bureaucrat is asked who applies for a bigger job, is how many people do you have working under you? Because the more people you have working under you, the better the case you can make that you can be the top manager of a bigger bureaucracy and manage even more people. And so there's a built-in incentive in government bureaucracies to be overstaffed and to have far more people working than is needed to do whatever task is necessary. Now, this sort of thing can happen in the private sector, and it does, overstaffing, where people can hire their golf buddies, for example, who aren't necessarily needed for the job, but they're there and out of cronyism. But there's always that bottom line. If money is diverted away from the stockholders in a big way to this sort of thing, the overstaffing of a corporate bureaucracy, the profits will go down, the benefits from being a manager will go down, because your salary and your perks and your promotions are based on profits. And also, you might incite a takeover, a corporate takeover, if it gets excessive enough, And if the firm is undervalued, so to speak, in that it could be making a lot more money, but it is being run by all these losers who happen to be the cronies of the top management. And so so there's a penalty to be paid. There's a cost to be paid by overstaffing in this way in the private sector. No such thing exists in the government sector. And so for that, that is one of the reasons why in the government sector we tend to see cost maximization. Another reason why we see cost maximization in the government sector is a phenomenon of binge spending at the end of every budget year. Because at the end of every budget year, if you do not spend every dime that has been allocated, you will have a difficult time making the case for a bigger budget next year, because you do have to compete with other bureaucracies, with a legislature or city council, depending on what kind of bureaucracy it is, for a fixed budget during the budget year. And so at the end of every budget year, there is usually a wild spending binge on anything and everything. The Washington Post has published exposés over the years of how there's enough furniture, for example, stored in warehouses in the Washington, D.C. area to furnish all of Washington, D.C. several times over, because year in and year out, all these bureaucracies do this. They go and buy, spend the money on big ticket items like expensive furniture, because that's a quick and easy way to spend large amounts of money and to have a plausible excuse for spending it. And so that's yet another reason why in government, cost maximization is the rule. And that's why government government enterprises are routinely far more costly and expensive in producing the same thing, same services that private sector entrepreneurs do whenever they do compete head-to-head with private sector entrepreneurs. And Rothbard also sort of ridicules the idea of business-like government. How many times do we hear that we're going to make it more business-like? Some of you may recall that during the Clinton administration, Al Gore, who was vice president, was put in charge of a reinventing government initiative, and they claimed that they were going to make government more business-like and streamlined. And, of course, they often do this. They often get corporate executives and put them in charge of some bureaucracy, and they claim that since the corporate executive did a good job at Corporation X, he will do a similar good job at Bureaucracy X and run it very, no waste, fraud, and abuse at all. But calling a government bureaucracy business-like is like calling a cat a dog or a dog a cat. It's just it's just a different animal altogether, because every business, of course, must persuade customers to voluntarily hand over money in return for products or services. The government doesn't bother with that. It can order you to pay or go to jail with income taxation and other forms of taxation as far as that's concerned. It can take your house from you if you don't pay all of the property taxes that you owe on the house to the local government. Government investment is also a ridiculous term. When governments talk about investments, they're talking about government spending. Politicians do not take risks. Investors take risks. If the investment doesn't pay off, they lose their investment. With government, though, if they invest in something like the Obama administration, has been in the news recently, in investing so-called in green jobs technology, which has been a giant a piece of corruption and financial boondoggling, they don't run any risk of losing any personal money. Barack Obama did not put a dime of his money up for these companies. And so business-like government is just an oxymoron, and it always has been, always will be, although governments use that kind of language all the time. And so and Rothbard makes quite a big deal of this. Another point that's important to recognize is that in the marketplace, we talk about goods because you can only survive in business if you're selling people things that they think are good and are worth having, worth paying for. But a lot of what government gives us are bads, but we pay for them anyway. And so it's not right to refer to the goods and services that government produces and the goods and services that private enterprises produce. A lot of what government produces are bads in the eyes of a lot of people. Maybe not in the eyes of everyone, but in the eyes of millions of people in a country the size of the United States. the war in Iraq, the war in Libya. These are bads to many millions of people, as is a lot of other things that the government does. The Transportation Security Administration is a bad in the eyes of millions of people. So we are, not only do we have the government producing bads, but we are forced to pay for these things. If a private corporation were to produce a thing that people decided was bad and not wanted, they would go bankrupt. They would go out of business. But of course, government never does. It just keeps giving itself more and more money. And so that's another important point to keep in mind, that the language of goods and bads is relevant to our discussion of comparing government bureaucracy with private bureaucracies. Rothbard also briefly discusses in this essay some differences between private advertising and government propaganda. Now, private advertising, it's easy to make fun of it. A lot of the ads are silly, but that's the point of the ad. They want you to pay attention and to know that the product exists. If they just tell you that this new product exists, they've done their job. They don't even have to tell you much about it, where you can get it or what the price is. If it piques your interest, you may find out on your own. And at the very least, they tell you the price and how it might compare or how to the competition or what some customers have said about the product or service so far. And so it serves in an informational purpose. And of course, government bans or restrictions on advertising are what is anti-competitive, because advertising basically is a competitive device that is used to try to win over customers, just like everything else businesses do has the goal of winning over customers. Now, government doesn't really have advertising, but in a true sense of real advertising, although it does advertise, it does promote itself. And one point I would make here is that the textbooks tell us that one of the reasons why the government is involved in so many things is the free rider problem. And the free rider problem basically says that people generally want much more government than they're willing to voluntarily pay for. Therefore, government must force us to buy these things that we really, really do want, but we have this attitude of let George do it, let somebody else pay for it. I'm going to be a freeloader, even though I really, really, really want this thing. Well, if that's true, if we really, really want all this stuff from government, why would there ever be a need for government to advertise at all? Why would they advertise? Why would the Army and the Navy have recruiting commercials on television? Why would the buses in the cities always be advertising this or that government program? Why would there be ads on television promoting the war on drugs and things like that, if we're all just dying to have more war on drugs and more wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East, but we're just too stingy to voluntarily pay for it? If that's true, there would never be any government ads of any kind. And of course, so the government ads are not really ads. They're propaganda. They're aimed at trying to manufacture consent. And they take advantage of what the public choice economists call rational ignorance. And the idea behind rational ignorance is that most people, when they acquire information that is useful to living their lives, it's mostly private information about your private life, how to do your job, how to get through school, how to raise your family, how to get the bills paid on time, those things, your private affairs. But when it comes to public policy, we tend to spend very little time really learning that much. And besides, government is so big and so dominant nowadays that it really is literally impossible for any human being to possess more than a tiny, tiny fraction of 1% of what even the local governments are involved in, let alone the state government and the federal government. And so most people are rationally ignorant of what government does. And so what that means is that not only do we have very little information about what government does, but a lot of what we do think we know is self-serving propaganda that is brought to our attention by special interest groups, including government bureaucrats themselves. And so a lot of what you get is an attempt to manufacture consent, or at least to get the people to acquiesce and not oppose what the government is doing. It is not competitive advertising in the true sense of advertising, because after all, most of what government does, it does as a monopoly. There's only one Defense Department, there's only one EPA, and so forth. So they don't really need to to compete with anybody. They give themselves monopolies in doing all these things, and so they don't have advertising at all. And Rothbard throws in here something that he talks about in his essay on the nature of the state, and that the role of intellectuals in promulgating the pro-state propaganda to get us to acquiesce, and naturally a paid propagandist like Paul Krugman would come to mind, the New York Times columnist, and of course there are many, many more so-called intellectuals who are promoters of the state and who help the state play the game of manufacturing consent. James Bennett and I wrote an entire book about this in 1992. It's called Official Lies, How Washington Misleads Us. And we purposely made it not gigantic. It was 300 and some pages, but because we wanted people to read it. But of course, you could write a book that's many thousands of pages with a title like that, as far as that's concerned. Another interesting point that Rothbard makes here is about information flows, the flow of information in private bureaucracies, corporate bureaucracies versus government bureaucracies. And basically, the flow of information that's used to allow the top management in a corporation, let's say, to make decisions on product lines and pricing and everything else, is gathered at the bottom. It's gathered at the bottom of the chain of command by the worker bees. And this information is put up through the ranks. It goes to the middle management and then to the upper management. And inevitably, some of this information is lost or distorted before it gets to the upper management. Then there's also the phenomenon of the yes man, of middle managers who only want to tell the top managers what they think they want to hear, not necessarily the truth about the markets. And some of that surely occurs in the corporate world, in the business world, but there's always that bottom line. There's always the profit and loss system. And what that means is that corporations that do a better job of utilizing information in a way that helps them maximize profits will thrive and survive and prosper and profit and will overtake their competitors who do not do as good a job. The competitors who lose and distort more information in their organization or who have an excessive number of yes men, as they're called, who tell the upper management what they think they want to hear, but not necessarily the truth, the cold, hard truth about markets. And so this sort of behavior exists in the corporate world, but it is disciplined by the profit and loss system. In government bureaucracies, there is no profit and loss system by definition, and so the yes men prevail. And so the people who are at the top of any bureaucracy tend to be the people who will always tell the president or the governor or the mayor exactly what they want to hear, that things are always great, things are always wonderful, and they're wonderful. Why? Well, because you're in charge. That's why they're wonderful. And so the type of information that the top decision makers are given in any government bureaucracy is necessarily a bunch of BS to a very large extent. It's information that the subordinates think the boss wants to hear. That's why they're the top subordinates. They're good at conveying that type of information. And so you have the role of yes men in politics. It's very important. And of course, every bureaucrat is inherently an empire builder who wants to build an empire and have as many subordinates as possible. Rothbard quotes an interesting old book on bureaucracy, where he says the oldest trick in the book is for the top bureaucrat who's the head of an agency who wants to be an empire builder, who wants to hire people to work under him or her, but you don't want somebody who's going to try to compete for your job and outshine you. And so what you do is you hire two people to compete with each other for your favor, and then two more and two more and two more to compete with each other, not to compete with you, but to compete with each other for your favor. That's how you build an empire, a bureaucratic empire. And of course, that means that whatever the task is that you're involved in, there are far too many people involved in it to do the task, even if it is a seemingly legitimate task that the government is doing. Rothbard also makes a big deal here, as you know, if you read the essay, on the spoils system versus the civil service system. And the spoils system, of course, is the system whereby when after an election, the winning party, the party that takes over the legislature or the executive branch, for example, gets rid of most or all of the political appointees who ran all the bureaucracies and then hires their own political faithful to come in. And that was thought by many for many years, it is thought to be corrupt because promotion and job tenure are based on political connections and not merit. Now, Rothbard makes a very strong case, as others have, that the old spoil system was actually virtuous, and that it's even an even worse system to have a permanent cast of government bureaucrats who have permanent lifetime tenure, and it's almost impossible to fire them, because once you do that, you create a cast of people who have no incentive whatsoever to do anything for the public. It's all about surrounding themselves with more perks and more power. And so, and that's, of course, is what the system has turned into. At least you break that up every few years with the old spoil system. Every time there's an election, you get a new cast of characters running the bureaucracies. And so the advent of the so-called professional civil service in the early 20th century was a bad thing in Rothbard's eyes, as far as that's concerned. And the old spoil system was not a perfect system by any means, but he makes the case that it was actually superior to the so-called civil service system that creates a system of a permanent cast of government bureaucrats running our lives in so many ways. And Rothbard does refer to Mises' famous book, Bureaucracy. So I thought I'd make a few comments on what Mises says, some of the things Mises says, some of the main points. And I guess the main point is he talks about the calculation problem in business, that is the calculation of profits and losses. And that's based on the ability to have markets that set the prices of goods and services, including the prices of all the inputs, the price of labor, the price of capital, and so forth, everything that goes into manufacturing products or providing services. And so what a profit and loss system does is it basically measures how successful a business is in getting inputs, resources that are worth, say, $1 million and turning them into products that people will voluntarily pay more than $1 million for. If that happens, then you have a profit. And that is proof that you have actually added value to society because you have turned $1 million worth of stuff, raw materials, coal, limestone, things like that, if you're in the steel industry, for example, into products that people believe are worth more than all these resources that you put into the creation of the products. And so that is a certificate of good performance, profit. And a loss is just the opposite. It tells you that you took $1 million, for example, worth of resources and turned them into something less than $1 million in terms of some products that people don't care for very much. That's what the old Soviet Union did for decades and decades. It took all of the fabulous resources of the Soviet republics and turned them into nothing, essentially. That was worth much of anything. They ate up all their capital. And of course, this process cannot occur in government because there are no profit and loss statements in government. And so Mises makes the point that a good manager will tell all of his division managers to simply, your job is to maximize profits, period. You don't need to give them detailed rules and regulations. You don't need to give them detailed instructions. You can give them some direction. If you're the type of person who's been in the business for 30 or 40 years, well, of course, you must know something about selling the product or the service. But you generally give them a lot of latitude, and you judge them, and you promote them or you don't promote them in their jobs. You give them bonuses or you don't give them bonuses based on profits, profitability. That's the bottom line. But in government, you can't do that. In government bureaucracies, because there is no bottom line. There are no profit and loss statements. So therefore, it is necessary to have detailed regulations describing what your job is as a government bureaucrat. And here's what Mises says. He says, thus, within the framework of a profit-seeking enterprise, responsibility can be divided. Every sub-manager is responsible for the working of his department. It is to his credit if the accounts show a profit, and it is to his disadvantage if they show a loss. His own selfish interests push him toward the utmost care and exertion in the conduct of his section's affairs. If he incurs losses, he will be their victim. Your career is at stake here, after all. He will be replaced by another man whom the general manager expects to be more successful, or the whole section will be discontinued. At any rate, he will be discharged and lose his job. If he succeeds in making profits, he will see his income increased, or at least he will not be in danger of losing it. His fate is at any rate closely connected with that of his department, and working for it, he works not only for his boss, but also for himself. That's in the private enterprise. But you compare that to bureaucracies. Mises says this. He says, now we're in a position to provide a definition of bureaucratic management. Bureaucratic management, meaning government bureaucratic management, is the method applied in the conduct of administrative affairs, the result of which has no cash value on the market. Government. Remember, we do not say that a successful handling of public affairs has no value, but that it has no price on the market, and that its value cannot be realized in a market transaction, and consequently cannot be expressed in terms of money. Government cannot be run on a business-like basis. And so what we need is some sort of rules and regulations and dictates. That's why bureaucrats are so steadfast in following all the rules. That's how they proceed. So when you're frustrated by some asinine sounding rule that the state university or the Department of Motor Vehicles or the IRS or whoever insists on enforcing, that's why. The one way to not get promoted is to break one of the rules that your superiors have written down for you as your behavior. As long as you follow all the rules, no matter how stupid they sound, you'll be okay as a government bureaucrat. You'll thrive in your career. Whereas if you follow stupid rules in business, of course, you lose customers and you lose money. One final thing I think I'll mention from Mises' bureaucracy that's sort of interesting is he talks about the bureaucratization of the mind in a world where there's a lot of government bureaucracy. And here's how he puts it. He says, the government pretends to be endowed with the mystical power to accord favors out of an inexhaustible horn of plenty. It is both omniscient and omnipotent. It can, by a magic wand, create happiness in abundance. The truth is that government cannot give if it does not take from somebody. It is not in the power of the government to make everybody more prosperous. Just listen to any speech Obama makes, and you'll see what von Mises is talking about, or almost any politician. And ultimately, Mises says, the question comes down to who should be in charge here? Who should be the master of our fate? And here's one of my favorite passages from the book Bureaucracy. Von Mises says, every half-wit can use a whip and force other people to obey, but it requires brains and diligence to serve the public. Only a few people succeed in producing shoes better and cheaper than their competitors. The inefficient expert will always aim at bureaucratic supremacy. He is fully aware of the fact that he cannot succeed within a competitive system. For him, all around bureaucratization is a refuge. Equipped with the power of an office, he will enforce his rulings with the aid of the police. That's what a bureaucrat does. Of course, the richest man in the world, Bill Gates, has no power at all to enforce anything. He must persuade you to buy his products, but the most menial, trivial bureaucrat in the world can force you to do things because he sits atop several centuries of the accumulated regulatory powers of the government. And so they can force you to do a lot of things that you don't want to do. Just go to an airport nowadays anywhere in America and you'll see what I'm talking about. And so I think I have 8:20. That's about the usual time for my overview. of and my, hopefully my elaboration on some of the main points that Rothbard made in his discussion of bureaucracy. And so I'll take a quick look at the chat, see if there happen to be any questions here from people who came in later. But as Danny said, I'm going to look at the Q&A and for questions, if you have some, and then I will read the questions and do my best to give you an answer. Let's see, I hit the Q&A, but I don't see anything there. I hit something on the chat. I'm not sure this is going to work, Danny, but nothing comes up on Q&A. So if you have questions, I guess write them in the chat again. Tony wants to know what Rothbard thought was the most essential elements of bureaucracy. Well, I would say the absence of a profit and loss system, which forces the imposition of Byzantine rules and regulations that bureaucrats enforce, and then also the incentive of every bureaucrat to issue more and more and more rules and regulations, because that's what gives them power and importance. And of course, that's what gives them an excuse to hire more subordinates to help them to enforce all of these rules and regulations. And the more subordinates you have, the better the case you can make for promotions. And one other thing I would mention is that regarding promotions, in a government bureaucracy, if you are somebody who actually is trying to do good, and you have somebody working for you who is a real stinker, and who really is an embarrassment, and a real screw-up. The civil service regulations make it almost impossible to fire any government bureaucrat. It can happen, but it's a very time-consuming procedure. It may take years. It may take hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal expenses, and no manager of any government bureaucracy would want to do that and make your life miserable. And so instead of firing people, the preferred route is to promote them. Instead of firing them, give them an incentive to leave, to get out of your hair. Give them a better job or a nicer location or something like that. And so that's what often is done. If you have a teacher who can't teach, for example, in a public school, the way to get rid of that person is to offer him or her a higher paying administrative job in the central administrative office. That way, the central administrative offices are staffed with hundreds of people who have been proven failures at education, and therefore they're given the job of administering the whole educational system of a city. And that's basically what happens in every city in America and in other countries as well. And so that's one reason why failure tends to be success in government, and that you can't fire people because of civil service rules, but you get rid of them by promoting them instead. Let's see. Yeah, Weber wrote about bureaucracy. There's another good, very good book on bureaucracy by Anthony Downs called Bureaucracy. Anthony Downs is a political scientist. He's one of the founding fathers of the public choice school. And he wrote a book called Inside Bureaucracy, is what it is. And it really is an ingenious analysis of how bureaucracies work. He's not an economist, so there's no Austrian economics in there. But if you really want an eye-opening book about the inner workings of all government bureaucracies, read Inside Bureaucracy by Anthony Downs. Let's see. Gerald Sullivan, would a non-bureaucratic army or police force ever be possible? Well, yeah, it's called private security guards. There are more private police in America than there are government police. Shopping malls, housing developments, all hire many thousands of private police. Although you do have a hierarchy, and you do have some sort of bureaucracy in corporate police functions, if it's a big enough company. Look at all the people who collect the money from the banks, the Briggs people, and other corporate Wells Fargo. That's a private police function there. And so, yeah, it's not only possible, but it's real. It's realistic. We have it already in the economy. And the same is true of an army. In fact, we do have private armies operating in Iraq and Afghanistan right now, so-called private, even though they get paid by the government. And so there's a whole course on this. The Mises Academy has offered a whole course on this. I think Bob Murphy taught a short course on anarchy, including a discussion of private defense. And so that's a pretty big topic. I would recommend reading some of the book, The Myth of National Defense, edited by Hans Hermann Hoppe, on that question. I see Eric Hagen is talking about traditional nonprofit universities operating much like government. We have nonprofit universities. I know about the American system. I don't know about other countries, but every university in America is either government supported or government funded, to some degree, with very few exceptions. I mean, there's Grove City College in Pennsylvania, and in Hillsdale College in Michigan, and even Hillsdale has indirectly taken some government money over the years, a tiny, tiny amount, but it has taken it. And so, but all the rest, just about all the rest are government funded to some degree, usually a very large degree. And so these are not really private institutions. Once you take government money, the government will control your curriculum. I teach at a private university, Loyola University of Maryland, and the percentage of the budget that comes from the state of Maryland is very, very tiny. I think it's 1% or less than 1%. There's some sort of government program in the state of Maryland that gives private universities some small subsidy. But as a result, they have to comply with state regulations regarding curriculum. If we want to start up a PhD program in economics, for example, we probably will not be able to because the University of Maryland has one, and they don't want competition. And so in return for taking a tiny bit of government funding, they accept government control of a lot of what they do. And it's not just over curriculum, it's over a lot of other things. And so the university system, it really is a socialist system in America because it is so heavily financed by tax dollars. Even if these institutions are ostensibly private universities, they're really not because they're so soaked in tax dollars, especially research money. The Eric's son goes to Grove City. Yeah, we have a very good, small but a very good economics department at Grove City. Two old friends of mine, Jeff Herbener and Sean Rittenauer, are Austrian economists who teach there. And so, if you will want your if you or your children or grandchildren want a good economic education in Austrian School of Free Market Economics at the undergraduate level, Grove City College in Pennsylvania is the place to go. Antonio Lopez wants to know, would an anarchist have a constitution? Well, yes, anarchists have had constitutions, even if they don't call themselves anarchists. I would recommend an article by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill entitled The Not-So-Wild Wild West in the Journal of Libertarian Studies, 1979. It's online. It's a Mises Institute publication, where they talk about the settlement of the American West. The wagon trains had written constitutions before you set out on a wagon train, and that was surely anarchy. There were no states yet in this part of the country. The state of Nebraska or the state of Kansas did not exist. These people just went out there, but they had their own written constitutions with their laws and bylaws, prescriptions against theft and things like that. And the same was true with the mining camps in the American West. Before the government even showed up, they had their own little constitutions, as did the cattle drives that existed before the states were formed and created and established formal governments. And so just in American history, you have examples of anarchy, so-called, having constitutions. Homeowners associations have all sorts of rules. When you buy a house in a housing development, that's a constitution. and you agree to live by these rules. And if you don't like the rules, you can buy a house someplace else. So that is a form of a constitution. Let's see, Matthew Tomko, yeah, yes, Mises was in favor of limited government. He was not an anarchist. And so he says if there are legitimate functions of government, you're just going to have to bite your lip and realize that it will, these functions will be performed by bureaucracies. That's what governments are. It's not the market. And so a little bit of bureaucracy will have to be tolerated. It was Mises' view. And so, but I am of a different opinion. Mostly Mises must have been thinking of law enforcement, enforcement of contracts, and national defense. But I think government has proven that it's not really interested in defending America with its so-called national defense, but in becoming a world empire and policing the world, which makes it much more dangerous for Americans because of the blowback that comes. The judicial system is completely corrupt. Several generations of lawyers, in my opinion, have ruined the Constitution as a restriction on government. And so this whole experiment in limited constitutional government, in my view, has been a failure. Only in theory can you talk about the desirability to have limited constitutional government. But I think if American history proves anything, is that this experiment has been a failure, and it has been for 100 years. So when you hear politicians talk about, or political activists saying we need to get back to the Constitution, it's totally unrealistic, pie-in-the-sky dreaming, because the real-world political forces won't permit it, and they never did. As we saw last week when we talked about Calhoun, these forces of constitutional destruction were hard at work as soon as the ink dried on the original U.S. Constitution. Chris Banco wants to know, why is government so against the merging of firms? The origins of this, you could probably Google an old article of mine called The Origins of Antitrust, an Interest Group Perspective. It was in the International Review of Law and Economics in the mid-1980s. Now, I believe it's online somewhere, so you can probably find it. And it's about the political origins of the first antitrust law, the Sherman Antitrust Act. And part of the reason is a misunderstanding of what capitalism is about and what competition is about, where a lot of people believe that the mere number of firms in an industry is a good measure of competition, when in fact it's not. When two firms merge, usually it's an attempt to become more efficient, because businesses are not so foolish to think that if they have 50 or 100 competitors and they merge with one of them, that somehow they'll be able to be a monopoly and charge higher prices. The usual reason is they think that there will be some sort of synergy created that will allow them to charge lower prices and to therefore earn more market share and more profits that way with mergers. And so a lot of it is economic ignorance. A lot of what goes on in any kind of government regulation is sort of an extortion scheme, where the government will throw out a threat to stop a corporate merger, which the corporations may think could create many millions of dollars in profits for them. And so they will respond by bribing the politicians to drop the action, to drop the Justice Department or the Federal Trade Commission's threats to block the merger. That's what's going on right now with the proposed merger between AT&T and T-Mobile, the cell phone companies. The Obama administration is opposing it. These two companies will then shower the Democratic Party with money, and don't be surprised if you read before the next election that they've dropped it. That's off. So I think there are a number of reasons why they oppose corporate mergers. Economic ignorance is one of them, and of course intellectuals, status intellectuals, have been a big help in that regard. And then just power politics. It's a tool. The regulation of mergers is used as a tool for political success of the ruling class, just like all other regulation is, in the way that I just described. see. What is my best idea on constraining bureaucracy and privatizing? That's my best idea. Is Ron Paul misguiding his plea for adherence to the Constitution? Well, he's educating a lot of people, but I don't see how the Constitution can ever be enforced unless we return to the system that was set up by Jefferson, who was the champion of the 10th Amendment and of nullification and of secession, because you can't trust the government itself to enforce the Constitution. If we have learned any lesson from history, that should be it. If any such thing is ever to be enforced, it must be enforced by the people themselves, or perhaps organized as political communities at the state or local level, by nullifying unconstitutional laws or by seceding from the U.S. if it becomes unconstitutional. Without that, I think it's hopeless, is my view. Ayn Rand wrote about public-private partnerships in a passage where she noted that government is always the senior partner, when you see the phrase private-public partnerships. And so the private companies will always sort of do some of the legwork, but what is ultimately done is what the government wants to be done, because it is always a senior partner. And so I think it's a foolish idea for the most part. Todd wants to know if the real world will permit anarchy on a large scale. Anarchy. What does that mean? It means voluntarism. Most of what we do in our daily lives is voluntarism. You go to the store, you teach your children things, you travel around in your car. You're not being controlled. You're not being told where to go, what to do, what to eat so much by the government. That's anarchy, if you will. It's a voluntary part of society. And so we do have a private sector and we do have a civil society, and you can call that anarchy if you want, because that's what it is. It's the voluntary sector. But if you mean have no government, probably not. Even the American Founding Fathers did not set up a system of individual secession where you could have no government. All you can do is hide. Yeah, Ayn Rand has a good piece about antitrust. Actually, it's written by Alan Greenspan. The essay on antitrust in Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, which I just happened to have on my desk. And it is... it's Alan Greenspan. The essay is just called Antitrust by Alan Greenspan, 1962, and it really is a good essay. That's back before Greenspan became a central planner. Eric, I see Chris found my old article on the origins of antitrust. There it is. Eric asks, does infrastructure qualify as a pseudo-investment? Well, sure. Sure it does, because there's such a broad definition of infrastructure. While there is no risk of profit or loss, at least what you are buying is supposed to return value over a period of time. Well, if the roads were privatized, that type of investment would be an investment. But what government does is not an investment, so I wouldn't call that an investment. Antonio Lopez has a question about the ideal size of a country as the size of other armies. So are large countries only possible through states? No, not necessarily. In large countries, it all depends on what you mean by a large country. A large military presence? That usually requires a state. It always has in history. But a large country based on capitalism, I think, is easily imaginable. If it thrives and people prosper and it grows, more and more people want to come and join and be there and prosper in peace, that would be a very big country, as long as it had the space. (Clears Do you think, Todd says, do you think Rothbard would agree that a balanced budget amendment would put chains? No, certainly not. Because Murray was familiar with an old book that I co-authored with James Bennett entitled Underground Government, the Off-Budget Public Sector. That was published in 1983. It was all about how governments have always easily gotten around balanced budget amendments, spending restrictions, borrowing restrictions, and so forth by spending money off the books or off budget. And so Murray Rothbard would not have been in favor of a balanced budget amendment. And also he would have understood that the bigger problem is the total amount of government spending, not whether or not the budget is imbalanced. He says in some of his writings, by the way, that he would much prefer a government with an unbalanced budget of $1 billion than a balanced budget of $2 billion. Because every dollar government spends, it commandeers one way or another from the private sector. And the private sector is the only source of efficient spending of dollars, whereas the government sector is almost entirely waste. And so Rothbard would never be in favor of something like that. Eric says, people being killed in his name makes him sick. It not only makes you sick, Eric, it makes it dangerous for you, because people who live in countries where our government is bombing and killing civilians, they assume that a lot of Americans are behind this. They watch CNN, and they see all the flag waving at the football games and all the patriotic displays, so-called, cheering on the soldiers and so forth. And so they naturally assume that the American public is fully behind all of this. And so, and they also naturally assume that they have a legitimate right to fight back, and whether it's through terrorism or something, anything else. And so, yes, not only makes you sick, it makes life much more dangerous for all of us. It's called blowback. Time spending to a percentage of GDP would not work either, says Todd, if they can hide so much money in the off-budget sector. That's true. If they can hide money off-budget, these things where you say government spending can only be a certain percentage of GDP, or it can only grow no faster than personal income grows, they can always hide spending. Or, spending is not the only way to influence the allocation of resources. Government regulation also is. And so government regulation is sort of an off-the-books way of allocating or reallocating resources. So if you had something that really did restrict government spending and was enforced, government could influence the economic world through regulation as an alternative. Matthew Tomko wants to know, can I recommend further reading that deals with the externality free rider problem? Sure. There's a book edited by Tyler Cowen on market failure. There's another book entitled Famous Fables of Economics. You can look these up on the web. Famous Fables in Economics is a edited book of essays. And I think the book by Tyler Cowen at COWEN is just called Market Failure, and it's been out for a long, long time. But both of these have essays that are mostly critical of the idea of the free rider problem, the market failure, and so forth. Also, The Myth of National Defense, edited by Hans Hermann Hoppe, has a very good discussion of the free rider problem from an Austrian school perspective in it. Todd is getting depressed. Well, I guess that's one of the things that can happen to you when you study Rothbardian economics. But Murray Rothbard was the most optimistic person I've ever met in my life. He was always upbeat about the future and a very enthusiastic, very bubbly personality. And one of the things to you can be more or be less depressed over is that you know, if you understand how markets work and entrepreneurship, think about this. The U.S. government nuked Japan in 1945, and by 1960, the Japanese people had recovered from that and were well on their way to economic prosperity, and it was through entrepreneurship. And so if you give people freedom, they will do amazing things. They'll produce more Bill Gateses of the world, for example. And so that's the optimistic side. If we can only just move in the direction of freedom, not total freedom. You don't need anarchy. You don't need a total 100% voluntary society, because we've seen huge advances in human well-being from relatively small increases in the amount of freedom that we have, especially freedom of enterprise. So don't get depressed in thinking that it's either an anarcho-capitalistic society or totalitarianism. That's a false choice. That's never been the choice. Tony Puella thinks I'm an old geezer because he says he thinks I've seen quite a shift being this movement for so many years. Well, yeah, it's changed tremendously. I've been associated with the Mises Institute almost from the very beginning. And in the early conferences we had every October, they were sort of conferences for donors where I would be there with Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell and a few others. We might have 20 or 25 people in attendance for a two-day conference. And now we have many hundreds of people who personally travel to Alabama and elsewhere. And in addition to that, many, many thousands of people who live stream the conferences on the web. Mises University is overwhelmed with applications, 260 students last summer, and many more turned down. And in the early days, we had 30, 40, 50 students. And so this, and that's just the Mises Institute. There are all sorts of other enterprises out there. So things have changed in terms of all the efforts that are being put into the whole freedom movement. Look at how popular Ron Paul is in purveying our ideas. Let's see, Eric again says, he heard an interview with Penn Jillette, that's Penn and Teller, the comedians, where he hoped we could at least get to the point where if there are two ways to achieve a policy result, we could get people to think about considering the way that increases liberty rather than restricts it. Well, yeah, that's the Ron Paul message, too. And I guess that's what we're all working on doing with our writing and teaching and so forth. And Ron is pretty good at doing that in sound bites, but that's what politicians do. They speak in sound bites. Joshua asks, what do I think our best actions would be as individuals to move us in that direction? Well, I believe in the division of labor. We all have our own specialties. Some of us are teachers. Some of us are writers. Some of us simply are good at presenting ideas to our friends and family and neighbors. Some of us put bumper stickers on our cars. Some of us work on the web, creating YouTubes. There are a lot of things all of us can do depending on what our interests are, what we have time for. What our knowledge base is, and so there's no one recipe that's best. I have no idea what's best. The market will decide what's best as far as our approaches, but we academics are sort of information factories and to some extent, and we just hope that, a thousand flowers will bloom from the books we write and the courses we teach, and people will take this information and give their own unique spin on it. And we all have our own specialization and division of labor. And it can be fun. Walter Block is the hardest working libertarian in the world, and he loves what he does. He really loves working 12 or 14 hours a day, writing and teaching and lecturing and sponsoring lecture series at his university. To some of us, it's kind of a fun thing. It's not all being depressed and work. He's hilarious. Yeah, he can be pretty funny, too. Walter can be pretty funny. And I think I mentioned this before, that there's another saying that's popular among the Mises crowd, that you cannot fight City Hall, but you can pee on the front steps and run away. And that's what a lot of us do, I guess, with things. Yeah, Freedom Watch and Stossel are pretty good steps, sure. We need more of that. YouTube and the internet is incredible. Also, in spreading the word, the government fears the internet. They're probably spying on us at this very moment. Well, it seems like things are sort of slowing down here, and people are just making statements. Okay, well, maybe it's at 8:52. Things are pretty much slowing down, so I guess we've run out of gas for tonight. And thanks for attending again. I hope you got something out of the evening lecture and the readings. And I'll see you again in a week. And have a great week. And I hope you'll like next week even better.